people to take their seats and settle in, even though we don't have a quorum yet. We're going to get started. Today is Monday, February 5th, and this is the Committee on Local Government and Metropolitan Affairs. The first item on the agenda, we are going to take up Tom Gillespie from the Minnesota State Demographer. Please come to the table and state your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Tom Gillespie. I'm the Minnesota State Demographer, and I, a position I have held since 1979. And thank you for inviting me here today to the committee. There is a handout short handout that I provided. I've been asked to address our current organization and our current task. The state demographer position was created by legislation in the early 1970s in the state planning agency. In fiscal year 2003, the demography office was transferred to the Department of Administration, and in 2006, fiscal year 2006, a group called the Geographic and Demographic Analysis Division was created within the Department of Administration, which includes the State Demographic Center. The State Demographic Center is now myself and three professional positions. The other units in the Geographic and Demographic Analysis are the Land Management Information Center, the Environmental Quality Board, and the state archaeologist, and all but the state archaeologist are former planning agency teams. The task of the state demographer are outlined in Minnesota Statute 4A.02, and can be divided into five main areas. One is population estimates. Each year we produce estimates of counties, cities, and townships outside of the seven county Metropolitan Council region. We produce about nearly 2,500 population and household estimates each year, and these are used for such things as local government aid formula, municipal street aid, and other formula purposes. We also assist with review and certification and technical assistance on other estimates, including more specifically. The annual community education levy estimates of population, work with the population of boundary changes, and also make miscellaneous special estimates on request from especially from other departments and from the legislature. And in recent days, those have included such things as the number of children in school by education of their parent, the number of children under five by poverty status, and the median age of Minnesota workers by occupation. And we to the extent that we have data, do produce those kinds of estimates on request. We also make population projections looking forward into the future. Our projections are normally 30-year forecast, normally most commonly done at a county level. Each decade, at least once a decade, we produce county age, sex, household, and labor force projections for 30 years. We are now just finishing up a revised estimate, revised forecast of county population by age and sex out to 2035, because we've had some requests along those lines. We have produced projections of cities and townships. At best, those should be used as illustrative purposes. Say the population of some cities and townships are very small and subject to boundary changes, and as a result, it can be difficult to make forecasts of cities and townships. But we do that. We also make special projections, such things as projections of high school graduates, which we did for the Office of Higher Education. We in addition to the estimates and projections, we identify and monitor and analyze trends in such things as migration and immigration, birth, death, racial and ethnic diversity, including national origin, demographic-related workforce issues, and then a variety of other trends looking forward into the future, such as working with the Army National Guard on recruiting efforts in terms of the potential population for recruitment, working with emergency management staff on identifying populations of special need that may need assistance in emergency settings. We also work with the U.S. Census Bureau in a variety of formal capacities, including federal state cooperative programs on estimates, projections, and the data center program, which is an information distribution program, and also work as the state liaison on issues related to the next decennial census. Part of which is helping prepare the data for the 2011 redistricting program, and in this in terms of working with the Census Bureau, we're also beginning to work with local governments on even as early as today with such things as updating their mapping and systems and making sure that the Census Bureau has the most recent information on the geography of local units of government. We also do outreach and provide data to many other units. We coordinate a statewide data center network of providers throughout the state who provide information to people on a local basis and particularly people who may have limited access to high-speed internet lines. We provide training on available data, publications, an online database system called DataNet that provides data at a county, city, and township level. And we also do a monthly brown bag on demographic issues. In addition to this, we also make public appearances. Last fiscal year, we made 138 appearances throughout the state, and we're on that same pace this year. Examples, for example, about a week ago, I was in Moorhead with the Clay County Joint Powers Commission. Recently with the University of Minnesota School of Dentistry, the Hennepin County Bar Association, earlier last year with the League of Cities Executive Board, School Board Association, school districts such as the Gibbon Fairfax Winthrop School District, and many others. That's all we do. Let me stop there and see if there are any questions, Madam Chair.
Okay. Questions from members? Representative Biscuit.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Mr. Gillespie, first of all, the legislature does rely heavily on good and up-to-date data that your office provides, and I appreciate that, and thank you for the work your office does. I do have a question, though. Another unit of pseudo-government, the Metropolitan Council, also relies heavily on demographic data. Mr. Gillespie, does the Metropolitan Council get its demographic data from you, or do they have their own demographer and do their own demographic studies?
Madam Chair, the Metropolitan Council is designated in statute to prepare the population estimates of places within the 7-county Metropolitan Council region, and so they do prepare their own estimates. We do cooperate with them and to the extent possible coordinate with them. They do have staff on board that work on demographic issues related specifically to the 7-county Metropolitan Council region.
Just 1 minute. We do officially have a quorum, so I will formally call the meeting to order at 4:10. All right, Representative Diskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, then, Mr. Gillespie, would you say that there is no redundancy in effort, and that you do not do demographic analysis in the seven-county metro area, and it's a metropolitan council that does that, and you get your data from them? Is that what I'm hearing you to say?
Mr. Gillespie.
Madam Chair, Representative Diskin, we received the population estimates that the Metropolitan Council produces and use those for all and all official purposes on such things as population projections. We make projections statewide and look at all counties in the state so that we can control to a total population and make sure that the population is consistent internally.
Representative Diskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I think this is something that this committee should look at then. When we're looking at migration of people throughout the state, if we have two entities who are doing the demographics and they're only peripherally working with each other, I think that's a problem. You know, when you look at that connection, I think it's probably important that all of the demographic data be done in one place and then used by the subsidiary agency. So maybe, Madam Chair, that's something we can delve into later on in this session.
Representative Fisher, is that a bill you'll be introducing? It certainly would be one I would hear.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Further questions? All right. If not, thank you very much. Actually, that is one of the reasons why you're here today, is to talk about who is doing what planning, and I actually will have a bill as well to bring back the Department of Planning. So thanks so much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Next on the agenda, we have John Adams. Please come to the table, state your name for the record, and then go ahead.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. My name is John Adams. I'm professor of geography at the University of Minnesota, and I was recently appointed as co-chair of the new University Metropolitan Consortium. We're not going to see for a while where that's going to go, but the consortium will coordinate research, teaching, and outreach at the university and other schools around the state concerned with topics, population change, land use, transportation, real estate development, state and local public finance, and environmental challenges in the metro area around the state, and what we can learn about what's happening in the rest of the country that would pertain to what's happening here in Minnesota and in our various sub-regions. So in the few minutes that I have, I'd like to outline some ideas about three topics. First is concerns public spending, next public investing, and the third, the urgent need for statewide and metropolitan planning for the changes that are sweeping over our nation, our region, and our state. We have to spend carefully to maintain what we have, and we have to invest wisely to improve the state's asset base. We have to understand the trends that are underway nationally and locally and clarify what they imply for public choices that face us, and that's what we mean by planning. Spending and investing are two different things, although they often get confused and lumped together in the heat of biennial budgeting. But in order for our state and our metropolitan areas, just like in our homes and families, planning and investing and spending should all go together. We know that at home, if we manage our annual income and outgo properly, our household balance sheet will be stronger at the end of the year than it was a year earlier. Assets will have improved faster than liabilities, or liabilities will have diminished. But if we draw down our assets in order to maintain our spending or allow liabilities to accumulate, then our household balance sheet is weakened. And although we don't explicitly have a state balance sheet, we do have major assets and major liabilities here in Minnesota. So the question confronting us as a state is, what's happening to those assets? What's happening to those liabilities in the face of major demographic, economic, and environmental trends? For example, Minnesota continues to grow in population and economic activity. We're told we can expect at least 1 million more people in our state over the next few decades. Tom Gillespie and his people are giving us a continuing stream of information about what's going on and what we can expect. And the questions are things like, will the newcomers be able to contribute to our economy and quality of life, or will they draw them down? The planning question is, where will all the newcomers settle? Where will they work? Where will they live? How will they be accommodated in housing, in jobs, in schools, in recreation? And will the infrastructure be in place to handle the increased loads? Most, but not all, of the newcomers will settle in the greater Twin Cities area, which now includes a commuting field of about 25 counties, including four in Wisconsin. The planning question is, how can growth be accommodated and new infrastructure be provided without ruining the very assets of our state that people are here to enjoy? Although some parts of the state are losing population, many of our state's regional centers continue to grow from immigration, from the children of immigrants, from domestic migration, from the children of domestic migrants, and in some cases, the rates of growth are outstripping local government's ability to manage, and development is putting serious burdens on natural environments. Many elements of the growth, new businesses, more households, additional public and private organizations, come to Minnesota to take advantage of what's here, but too often they're reluctant to pay a fair price for what they get. They really don't understand that by not paying, the costs are piling up elsewhere, either shifting the burden to others or drawing down state assets at a time when we should be building them up. And that's what we mean when we say we need investment. It also requires planning, and planning may imply a serious look at the state authorizing the imposition of development impact fees on new developments so that fair prices are paid for the benefits that new development extracts from the system. About 25 states around the country permit the imposition of development impact fees, which require that new development pay for the additional off-site investment requirements that it imposes on local governments, things like school buildings, police stations, arterial road connections, parks and libraries. At present, Minnesota does not permit the levying of development impact fees, and maybe it's time for us to consider authorizing them in a new rethinking of what the state should be doing in the area of planning. We need to think harder about preserving and improving the assets of our state that have made it a special place and stop taking those assets for granted. That means being sure that we are building them up rather than drawing them down by neglecting them. For example, highways in need of repair and replacement, impaired lakes and streams, contaminated groundwater, obsolete school buildings and university research facilities, or maybe what's most important, an undereducated and untrained group of young folks entering the labor force and so forth. It seems to me that in many respects, the traditional principal assets of our state, human capital, the built environment, important institutions, for example, schools, colleges, universities, our transportation infrastructure, our natural environments, are being used and used up faster than they're being replaced or expanded or improved. So we should distinguish between, first, spending on an annual basis for services and for maintaining our asset base, and secondly, investing in basic assets in order to improve our competitive position with other metropolitan systems, other states, and with our rapidly expanding foreign competition. The investing that's needed should be carried out according to statewide planning process that anticipates the future and invests current resources to improve the state's future competitive position. Minnesota used to be a leader, widely known and widely respected leader in statewide and metro planning, but out of perhaps smugness or short-sightedness or complacency, we slipped in recent years in our attentiveness to the future. What we need to do today to ensure that the future of the state and all of its parts remain bright. That means we need to strengthen our state's balance sheet by building up these assets and working to reduce future liabilities as part of a rejuvenated statewide planning process. At the present time, it seems to me that the state's balance sheet is eroding, with assets being depleted and liabilities accumulating, but I think we're smart enough to do better. Bob Johns will speak in a minute specifically about our recently completed Transportation and Regional Growth Study, which looked at several ways to assess and improve our transportation asset base. That's just one example, especially here in the greater Twin Cities region. So that's my statement. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, an apology to the committee for the little event with Representative Hausman's chair. We really were trying to help her there. Not that we were trying to sink her out of sight or anything. So I'm sorry for interrupting the witness when he was getting started. Just a comment here, and this will be political, and you know I'm not very partisan, but on the top of page 4, I just want to let the committee know, and probably the witness, that I take umbrage at the first paragraph there. Out of smugness, short-sighted, and circumplacency, we've slipped in recent years, that's since I've been here, Mr. Adams, to do what we need to do to ensure that the future of our state remains bright. Now, I'm not sure what building up assets means, or I think there was a thing over here. We were talking about investment. To some of us, those are code words for tax increases. I think you'll agree that there is a philosophical difference between some of us here about taxation and whether or not money that actually stays in the private sector counts towards investment, whether or not we trust people to do the right thing. Maybe we give them some guidelines, perhaps, to build their own homes and raise their own kids or build their own churches and private charitable organizations. Those are all part of a larger discussion that we're having, but as someone who doesn't like raising taxes, although perhaps for the gas tax, which is another story for another day, I assure you, I do not feel smug or short-sighted or complacent in the least about trying to make the state a better place for my grandkids in particular, all of whom live in greater Minnesota, a small town in the southwest part of the state. Madam Chair, I just had to get off my chest, and nothing personal, because I'm sure you mean well, but as we're having this discussion, notice that some of us do pay attention to the philosophical and partisan nature of the discussion, and as one who doesn't like to be real, one with sharp elbows, as I'm sure you all know, when I feel a sharp elbow, sometimes I'm just cranky enough, I like to give it back, so there, that was a sharp elbow, my version of one, anyhow. Thank you.
Thank you for the comment. Representative Chumper.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Adams, I also don't like to be partisan, but I I was making notes here to myself that this is the most thoughtful set of ideas that I've read in the last 4 weeks that I've been here, especially number 6. I thought it hit it right on the head, and I want to commend you for that. I really think we aren't doing enough for our principal assets in our state, and I'm glad somebody articulated that so well. This is a great little piece, and I'm going to try to figure out some way of sending it to all our colleagues in the House here. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hausman.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. These two speeches were the perfect introduction to my question, which is, does planning in a partisan setting have a bigger challenge in that from administration to administration, there is sometimes an ideological shift that would change how we might view what planning is or what direction it might take in terms of outcomes?
Mr. Adams.
Madam Chair, Representative Hausman, planning, the word planning has a bad rap. Some of us think that it got a bad reputation after World War II when in some parts of the world where centralized planning was imposed, it was interpreted as somebody on top telling everybody else what to do. That's not what planning is. I teach, or at least until recently taught in the Humphrey Institute Planning Program. In fact, I was the first director of the Humphrey Institute Planning Program. And we understand planning as anticipating to the best of our ability what the major trends are that are overcoming us, laying out the possible implications of those trends, and let letting the elected representatives at all levels of government figure out what kind of decisions need to be made in the presence of good information and understanding of major trends. Nobody's trying to tell anybody what to do. But the example I put in the little piece here, for example, the United States expects to add about 100 million people over the next 3 decades or so. That's a lot of people. And the question is, where are they going to go? And what impact are they going to have on all of our wonderful aspects of our country? We can't just plunk down 100 million more people, and Minnesota's got 5 million people in it, we're going to get our share. We can't just let, or we can, I suppose, let things happen and then put up with the consequences. Or we can anticipate different possibilities and think about the implications of different courses of private and public action and let everyone know what those courses of action are, and then let thoughtful people in the public sector as well as in the private sector make their decisions about what they're going to do with a full understanding of what the costs and benefits are of short-term action versus longer-term action. And when it comes to questions of assets and investing in assets versus spending for maintenance and spending for consumption, certainly at the household level, we understand what that means. When we build an airport or build a highway, whether we pay for that short-term out of current revenues or whether we bond in order to pay for it, we know what an asset is. The interstate highway system is an asset. We built it over a 15-year period from the late 50s to the early 70s, and now we're using it. In my opinion, and I look at some of these things pretty closely, the cost of using it includes both the daily maintenance of it, but it also includes the deterioration of it. And anybody who's in business knows, for instance, you buy a machine, it's going to last for 10 years, you depreciate it over a 10-year period, and every year, a tenth of the cost of that machine gets incorporated into the cost of doing business. We don't tend to think quite that way in the public sector, and all I'm suggesting here is, if we did think that way a little more carefully, we might make decisions a little bit differently. Because when a highway wears out, that's a real cost, and it should go into a budget someplace as a cost. That's what I was talking about here. We do the same thing in our house. My wife's always telling me we need to do this, we need to do that, or this house is going to fall down around our heads. Yeah, she's right. But what do we do about that? Well, once in a while you borrow money to make a major improvement, and then if you don't keep it up, it starts wearing out. That's a real cost. It's the same thing in the public sector, and that's what we're talking about here. Whether it's highways, or whether it's contaminated streams, or whether it's some kind of a disease overtaking our pine forest, whether it's a plume of contamination in the groundwater, these are serious matters that represent to me some kind of a slow kind of wearing down. And when we put a little bit too much chemical on the farmland and some of that seeps into the Minnesota River and then we've got a problem with fish, all of these things are connected. And all I'm saying here is planning will help us see the big picture, help us see what's connected with what, and then lay out what the possibilities are, and then we can decide what we want to do about it. We either want to put up with the cost, or maybe we want to back off and make a decision to try to do something in a different way. That's all. And I think we can do a better job of that. This is smart land, but I do think that we take things for granted here because it has been such a wonderful place for such a long time. I was born here. I'm a native. My parents are natives. You know, I've been here a long time. I've been watching this for almost 70 years. So it isn't as though I'm just in off the plane. I'm concerned. It's my state, and I want to see a better job done. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Olson.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Adams, it's a good colloquy here. Interesting comments. I, too, want to see a better job done. You highlighted how many people are we expecting in the next 30 years?
About a million. On top of the five already here. Now, I'm not sure Gillespie can tell us better than I whether it's going to be 22 years or 28 years or something like that, but it's going to happen. There's no evidence to the contrary.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll just question, comment, take it either way. I just want to raise a concern, and I'd like to know if this is often discussed. The trend that I've seen in my area, reflective of what's going on in the state, is that we aren't just bringing people in. I noted here earlier there's a migration and immigration matter going on. When you talk about planning, it concerns me greatly that we have people leaving rural Minnesota. We have people leaving rural America, and then we're densifying and trying to pack everybody in the urban and suburban areas. And looking at that many more people coming in, it reflects poorly on what we've been doing for planning. Do you have any comments on that?
Mr. Adams.
Representative Olson, we did a couple of studies at the Center for Transportation Studies that looked at what's happening in what we call Greater Minnesota, as opposed to Lesser Minnesota, where I live. These regional economies throughout our state vary a great deal in what's happening to them. Some are weakening in terms of their population and economies, and others are flourishing. It's not a consistent picture at all. 2 weeks ago, I was up in the Brainerd Lakes area giving a talk, and they're suffering in the Brainerd Lakes area with lots going on that's putting substantial pressure on the natural environments, on the roads, and all the rest. Whereas in southwestern Minnesota, there are many places, for example, that are having a tough time. However, the regional centers, the 49 regional centers across the state outside the metropolitan area, which serve as the principal nodes on the state's trunk highway system, vary significantly in how they're changing, both in terms of the populations of the core cities as well as the towns and townships that surround them. And in many of these cases, what's happening is that these places are taking on some of the character of the Twin Cities, but at a much reduced scale. That is, many of the populations throughout these commuting areas focused on these regional centers are becoming low-density neighborhoods with people commuting one way or another to jobs. We track this with our data from the state Highway Transportation Department. People are retiring to small communities because they like the atmosphere, and then they're commuting sometimes as much as 90 minutes to jobs. Pick a place to live that they like, pick a place to work that's satisfactory, and then connect the two with daily commuting, sometimes up to 90 minutes one way. There's a great deal going on. We published two rather extensive reports on this at the Center for Transportation Studies, and these are available to anybody who wants to look at them. But in terms of your specific concerns about what is happening to rural Minnesota, this is one of the things that a comprehensive state planning activity could help us document and also highlight what it means for things like schools, shopping, jobs, opportunities for young people leaving school, the kind of investments that we should be making in our young people so that they have more options than they may otherwise have. All of these things could be clarified in a more systematic planning effort, where planning is understood to mean monitoring closely what's going on, anticipating what the consequences of different courses of action will be, and then leaving it up to people at every layer of government, from the towns and townships, to the cities, to the counties, to the larger districts, to decide what to do about it. We've got lots of government in Minnesota, as we all know, and they need more information, and they need more unified opportunities to take that information and use it in the important decisions that they're responsible for making. That's all I can say at this point. I'm not at all discouraged, because I think that we've got people like yourselves who want to understand this better and want to do more about it. I think we have been, to some extent, a bit concerned in the last 10 to 20 years, trying to balance budgets and all of the rest, and some of these longer-term issues have been maybe shunted aside to some extent. But I think I sense that now we're moving to a new appreciation of what lies ahead of us, and I think this challenge of a million more people might serve as some sort of a flag to get our attention, and it's going to mean a different thing to different parts of our state. Some counties are going to continue to have a tough time because they're losing people, assets, resources, but others are going to be having a tough time because they're not prepared to confront the changes that are overwhelming them. They're just not set up to do that. That's kind of long-winded, but I think I better quit and let Bob Johns come in.
Okay. Actually, we have a few more questions.
You do?
And
uh-oh.
Then as soon as we finish with you, we're actually going to move to Representative Huntley's bill, and then we're going to come back to Mr. John. So with that, Representative Dominguez.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Professor John Adams, in your number one comment, your example, could you enlighten us on what you meant by will the newcomers be able to contribute to our economy and quality of life? Could you give me more example of what you mean by that, and could you help us share the sunshine, so to speak, of how we could change that?
Mr. Adams.
Madam Chair, Representative Dominguez, I am very happy to see the changes that are occurring in our state in terms of population change and increasing variety of talents and backgrounds and skills that are coming to Minnesota. For about a half a century, this state was very homogeneous. From the middle 1920s, when immigration into the United States declined, and the middle 1970s, with the influx of newcomers from East and Southeast Asia, we had a relatively stable population composition here in Minnesota. And in that stable population composition, we paid no attention to issues of diversity. We had new things that could be done in a routine way, and now things have begun to change. I work at the University of Minnesota, and it's vivid every day what newcomers from throughout the world are bringing to our university and to our state in terms of new ideas, new talents, new backgrounds, new outlooks, new opportunities that in that earlier time here in Minnesota were unknown. We really have been, up until the last 25 years, a kind of cultural island, kind of flyover land, and people coming from other parts of the country, other parts of the world. This was the last place to get to. I mean, Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota are a long way away from the major ports of entry. But I think that newcomers bring new skills, background, talents, and ambitions that energize our state. And the question that we have is, are we prepared to provide the assistance that's needed to bring all of those talents and all of those resources to full fruition? And look at our schools, for instance. It's one thing to teach in a school where every kid in the school comes to school speaking standard English. If we have a school where 25 kids speak 20 different languages, we've got to respond to that in a fresh way and figure out how to help these young people develop to their full potential. We're a little bit behind the game here. In a place like Pennsylvania or California, where there's been variety for decades, this has already been addressed. Here in Minnesota, we're still getting used to the idea that we have classrooms with 15 or 20 different languages spoken at home. But that is a challenge. We can respond to it. We know how. But I think that we're moving from behind rather than up in front of this kind of a challenge. So I'm not troubled. I believe everybody has potential. I think it's the responsibility of the private and public sectors in our state to make sure that every young person develops to their full potential. And I think that's a challenge, because if we don't do it, we don't take a young person and turn that person into an asset to our state. Instead, by neglecting our responsibilities, young people can turn out to be a challenge.
Thank you.
So that's about, I guess everybody would agree with these sentiments, but
thank you. We actually had two questions left, and so if we could make the question brief as
and
well
the
as
answers.
The answer brief, that would be great. Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. and Mr. Presenter, I just thank you so much for bringing this to us. I was looking at number four here, where it talks about planning, and on page three, you talk about the 25 states that permit the imposition of development impact fees. And I have a daughter that lives in Florida, and we talk politics all the time, so I have a high phone bill. But there they have an impact fee in Orlando, so that when a subdivision comes in, and they have no state income tax, but when a subdivision comes in, a new school comes in with it. And I'm reminded of what happened in Hugo not too long ago, is that they needed an elementary school, and the citizens of White Bear Lake, who are struggling with school costs, the schools were in the wrong place. So now they all have to pay for this new school in Hugo, where the new development is coming. And I agree with Representative Beard that we don't like to raise taxes, neither do I, but we like to raise fees. And when I see something like development impact fees, I think that it would help somebody like Representative Marquardt, who then struggles with the property tax committee and trying to figure out how to assist local governments in paying for these. So I applaud you for bringing this up. And if 25 states can impose development impact fees to lessen the burden of the local property taxpayer, I would think that that would be a good idea. Thank you.
Representative Diskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, you know, much like baseball mom and apple pie, I'm not going to be bashing planning. It's kind of a no-brainer. And Madam Chair, just for the record, I know why Representative Beard doesn't like to get too partisan. He just likes to egg on that sap who serves on the other end of his Senate district to do that job. So, Madam Chair, I do have a question about the accuracy of the presentation put before us, and I'll ask staff. And it goes right to the point that Ms. Scalzi, or Representative Scalzi, just mentioned, and that's development impact fees. Madam Chair, I served on the City Council in the City of Jordan for a few years, and I know that on new developments we did impose park fees. Madam Chair, if I could ask of staff, is there a prohibition in statute from collecting the fees that are listed on page 3 of this testimony?
Ms. Dyson.
Madam Chair and Representative Biskins, there are specific fees that are authorized in statute. As you mentioned, the park dedication fees in subdivision developments in the municipal planning statute. There is not a general authorization for all kinds. For example, we do not have school impact fees. So there are some very specific ones that are authorized in statute that cities use.
Madam Chair, could I just make one comment?
Yes, Mr. Adams.
There's a distinction here between off-site and on-site. If a development of a particular size, can contain, how shall I say this? If it's large enough, many municipalities do require that the development include in it land set aside for schools, land set aside for other things inside the development. What I'm talking about here is off-site, outside the specific development, but creating demand for off-site activity rather than on-site. The on-site, off-site distinction here is what I was referring to.
Okay, with that, actually, there is the Blue Stays here, and we have all of these people who
Madam
are
Chair,
here.
Madam Chair, I do have one other point I'd like to make.
I will let you make the point, but as soon as you make the point, we're going to finish up, and we're going to move on to Representative Huntley's bill. So with that, Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members of this committee, I would urge you to consider the implications of development impact fee. Having heard from my colleagues across the aisle for many years now, I know that you share, as do I, the concern for affordable housing. And every time a new fee is put upon a developer, the developer isn't going to be paying that fee, Madam Chair. The people purchasing the houses are the ones who are going to be paying that fee. This is a backdoor increase on the cost of housing stock, and one I think we need to be very careful of. Thank you, Madam Chair.
With that, Representative Biskins. And with that, thank you very much, Mr. Adams. And we're going to call down Representative Huntley. I would entertain a motion that House File 163 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to Finance. Representative Hausman. Representative Hausman moves. So with that, Representative Huntley, please go ahead.
Madam Chair and members, I'm here with the mayor of the city of Duluth, Herb Bergson, and some of us call this the Duluth Room. If you look at all these lithographs from the Works Progress Administration in the 1930s, they're all scenes from the city of Duluth. There is an amendment, Madam Chair, and let me, before we get to the amendment, if I can just briefly introduce the bill, and then I'll do it in more detail later and then turn it over to the mayor. This bill allows the city of Duluth to invest two pots of money with the Public Employee Retirement Association and the State Board of Investment. I'll go into the reasons we need to do that. The amendment takes care of an issue that was brought up in the Government Operations Committee. There was some concern that that the state might be liable for any of the investment strategies that were used by the PARA or the State Board of Investment. The amendment clearly makes sure that the state is not responsible for that. The city of Duluth is responsible for the investment strategies. So if someone would move the amendment, I would appreciate
Representative Hausman.
And Madam Chair, I would move H0163A1 to get the bill in the form the author desires.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. With that, Representative Huntley, go ahead.
Madam Chair and members, the city of Duluth has a major problem that's of its own making. From 1983, I believe, in which at that time, as trade-off for some other items, they promised retirees of the city that they would have free health care for the remainder of their lives after they retired. Since that time, the city has put no money aside to fund that. And with the advent of the Enron accounting scandal, bills were passed in Washington that requires the city to meet the same standards that private companies do in terms of fully disclosing what their liabilities are in the future. This particular one is a huge issue. It's been estimated to be about $300 million. And to put that in perspective, the city's budget is about $78 million a year. So this is many times the annual budget of the city is a potential problem that the city is facing. They have a legal obligation to these retirees to take care of that. One of the ways they can help this problem is if they invest the money at a higher rate of interest than they can currently get according to the laws in which they operate under. This bill, as amended, would allow them to invest money with the State Board of Investment and collect the kind of returns the State Board of Investment usually gets, which are significantly higher than what the city's been able to get in the past. I've all passed out, this committee did not hear from the legislative auditor, but he issued a study about 2 weeks ago on post-employment benefits for public employees, and if you go to page 3 of this report, over on the right side, I've kind of circled it, he suggests that cities, school boards, whoever gets into the kind of problems that the city of Duluth is in, be allowed to set up what's called an irrevocable trust fund, which means the money that goes in there can only be used for the specific purpose that is stated. And while Duluth has a serious problem, it's not the only city or school board in the state, and the legislative auditor thought that there's a $3 to $4 billion problem hanging over the state and its local units of government. So a Duluth share of that is $300 million. The other thing this bill does is allow the city of Duluth to set up an account to be managed by the State Board of Investment for another purpose, which is basically city roads.
Yeah.
And with that, I'll turn it over to the mayor.
Mayor Bergson, go ahead.
Madam Chair and committee members and Representative Huntley, thank you for the opportunity to be here today. I am Mayor Herb Bergson, Mayor of the City of Duluth, and I am here with staff and citizen lobbyists who are in support of this House file, number 163. Its companion Senate file number 60 is also being heard at this time and will next be heard by the Finance Committee. As Representative Huntley mentioned, 23 years ago, there was a benefit promised to employees, and unfortunately, there was not money set aside to pay for that promise. We have been now working for about 3 years to put a plan together. As you know, many of you know, we were here last year trying to get a similar bill to this passed. Unfortunately, it didn't make it, but we hope that that we can get this one passed this year. There are three features in this legislation that allow us to resolve our problem ourselves. We're not here asking for any money. We're here asking for legislation that will allow us to be a little more aggressive with our investments. And knowing the history of these funds, we don't look at a one-year quick fix. We look at this in terms of a 20 to 30-year plan, knowing that some years are going to be good years and some years aren't going to be so good. We know that. And we're told that by the people who invest the money for us. The first feature of legislation is it creates an irrevocable trust fund, and GASB insists that everyone identify what their unfunded liability is. So everyone in the state of Minnesota is going to need to identify what their obligation is and start to set money aside for it. You're going to have to pass some kind of broad-based bill for the rest of the state. I think we all know that. We're just asking for a Duluth bill and a start. Every day costs us money. It costs us a lot of money every day. The second component is the ability to invest the money we set aside for retiree health care with the State Board of Investments. We would start that with a large sum of money coming from our Community Investment Trust, which presently has a balance of $60 million in it. Now, the plan is to draw that down to $50 million and use another $2 million from our fund balance in our health care fund. Presently, the Community Investment Trust Fund is used as an endowment fund of sorts, and the interest pays for street improvements in the city. Now, because we're shrinking that by $10 million, we're going from $60 million down to $50 million, obviously we need some help in paying for the street bonds that have already been issued. And that help comes in the form of also being allowed to invest the Community Investment Trust Fund with SBI to get a higher interest rate. And I just want to draw an analogy here, and that is, we presently have $60 million, and let's just say for sake of argument, we're going to get 4%. That's $2.4 million per year. And let's say we reduce it to $50 million, and we only get 5%. Let's just say we only get 5% on the money we invest with SBI. That's $2.5 million. So we actually increased the percentage of interest that we would receive just by allowing us to invest the money with SBI. We have in the audience with us today representatives from PARA, from SBI. I also see members of AFSCME here who have testified in the past in support of this bill. And all of these people from Duluth are here specifically today because you're hearing this bill and in support of it for our community to become fiscally solvent to be able to resolve this problem. And I'm here for questions. My finance director is here to answer questions, and I don't want to speak for them, but I think that SBI and PARA representatives would answer questions as well.
Thank you very much. Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Representative Huntley, I'm looking at page 2 of the Legislative Auditor's Report, and down on the left-hand column in the last paragraph, it says a study by the State Auditor estimated that 21% of 1,730 local units of government, school districts, yada, yada, yada. I guess my question, Representative Huntley, you know this is an issue that I support. This is a bill that Representative Murphy and I introduced in the legislature last year. So this is a bill that I'm going to vote for. But my question to you, Representative Huntley, why just one bill? I know... Representative, our chair, is a rather busy lady, all right? And I'm hoping, you know, 21% of 1,700 is over 350 local units of government, and I think Chair Hillstrom probably doesn't want to hear another 349 of these pieces of legislation. Can you enlighten us, Representative Huntley, as to why you didn't propose a statewide fix? I have asked House Research to show me what that looked like, and in fact, it's a few less words than this bill, so it's not more extensive. And so just what's your thought behind that, Representative?
Representative Huntley.
Madam Chair and members, I agree with Representative Biskins that the auditor does think that all cities that have potential problems should be allowed to do this. I agree. I think we just got in line first. We tried it last year, and it sort of got bogged down in the last days of session. And so we submitted this bill, and we're here today, and I would certainly support another bill that would let everybody in.
Representative Biskins, the other reason is this actually has two pieces in this provision. It has an irrevocable trust and a revocable trust. And so that's the reason I'm hearing this separately, because there is two pieces rather than just hearing the blanket bill, which I don't think has been introduced yet. So, Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Huntley. And I'd like to take you for your word and work with you. Bring the speaker's vision of coming together, reaching across the aisle, hands across the water. I think we could make a pretty powerful force in moving forward. Representative Huntley, I do have one other question, which was a bone of considerable debate last year on the bill that Representative Murphy and I brought forward, and that is allowing these trusts to be created solely through the State Board of Investment rather than allowing local municipalities to create the trusts out in the marketplace. Can you do you have any thoughts on that, or maybe the mayor has some thoughts on that, why we would I know the State Board of Investment does have excellent returns, Madam Chair, but I just wonder about creating the monopoly rather than letting local units of government invest the funds where it might do even better work in their own areas.
Mr. Bergson.
We don't want to get caught up in that argument. Last year, that was one of the issues that delayed things, as you probably recall, Representative. We saw going strictly with SBI as the means to get this through the quickest. We need quick. This problem has gone on for 23 years, and each day that it goes by, the cost increases. We tried to be the good guys by starting early, and couldn't get it through last year. We saw an opportunity for a Duluth-only bill getting through quicker this way and seize the opportunity. So we hope it can get through. We're told that the statewide version may be quite different in where they can invest the money. So we don't care. We just don't want to get lumped in and delayed. We want to fix this problem ourselves. We'll be happy to offer ours as a model for other cities, but we just want to get ours passed.
Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you tell me, an employee hired today with the City of Duluth, would they receive such generous post-employment health benefits?
Mr. Bergson.
We have five employee unions. One union has settled their contract, and hires now receive a defined contribution instead of the defined benefit. We have tentative agreements with three other unions, and in those tentative agreements, they would receive a defined contribution instead of a defined benefit. And we are still in negotiations with our AFSCME unit and do not have an agreement with them yet.
Thank you.
Further questions? Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Huntley or Mr. Bergson, can you tell me how many employees are involved in this current liability?
Mr. Bergson.
Retireds and actives is in the neighborhood of 2,300? 2,160.
Thank you.
Representative Solberg.
Madam Chair, Representative Bergson, I'm sorry, or Mayor Bergson. As you invest the street bonds, you've actually sold bonds at a particular interest rate, have you not?
Correct.
And when you invest that into a higher interest rate, have you checked out whether or not that's acceptable underneath the federal arbitrage? Am I at the right word?
Mr. Bergson.
The money isn't actually invested. It's just used to pay for the street bonds. We have a compact with the Indian Casino, and each year we receive money that goes into the Community Investment Trust, and it's just the earnings that are used to pay off the street bonds. There aren't any arbitrage problems with it.
So you're not having, did you sell bonds to begin with for the street?
Mr.
Project?
Well,
Madam Chair, we can shorten this. You've checked it out with everybody, then I'm fine.
All right. Mr. Bergson.
Yes, we have.
Thank you. Further questions from members? Representative Diskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and to staff, does GASB 45 standards allow you know, the giveaway that we had seen prior to its passing by the federal government?
Ms. Dyson?
Madam Chair, I actually don't know anything about GASB 45. I can ask someone.
I can ask the
question. I don't know.
Mayor Bergson.
Mayor.
GASB 45 doesn't prohibit giving the benefit. It just demands that you identify what your liability is and carry it on your books.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Further questions? If not, Representative Hausman renews her motion that House File 163 as amended be recommended to pass and be sent on to Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair and members.
All right. With that, we are going to call for Mr. Johns to come back. And while he's doing that, I'd entertain a motion to approve the minutes.
So move.
Representative Dominguez moves the minutes. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Minutes are adopted. With that, please state your name for the record, and please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Bob Johns. I'm Director of the Center for Transportation Studies at the University of Minnesota. I've been asked to speak about transportation planning. We're always glad to be a resource for the legislature. In fact, recently had sponsored two seminars at the university on transportation issues, and Representative Hausman, Representative Beard attended most of the House Transportation Committee. Just a little background on our center. Our goal is to advance the land-grant mission of the university in the field of transportation. Transportation is a very multidisciplinary field. We have a large research university, so we're able to call on many different disciplines, many different departments to carry out research and education in transportation. That land-grant mission is three parts, as you know, research, education, and outreach. Research is a major goal of ours where we are trying to leverage any state funds that we have for transportation research, and we have a good partnership with MnDOT and the Local Road Research Board and some others, to attract federal funds, private funds, foundation funds, and we've been quite successful. Our budget last year was about $20 million of research in a variety of areas involving over 50 or 60 faculty members, many graduate students. I've given you a copy of our annual report that was recently published for 2006, which can give you a good overview of the activities that we carry out. Today, our focus is on planning. We don't have a lot of time, so I'm just going to touch on some of the things that we're doing that have implications for planning, give you a sense of the studies that we have going on, focus particularly on one that Professor Adams already has referred to. We don't do planning. You know, the research and planning go hand in hand. we are an educational resource for those who do planning. So this, the government entities that do planning, but even the non-government entities that are involved in the planning debates, we feel we are a good resource to get information out to make informed decisions to advance the debate in transportation. We have influence with the study I'm going to briefly describe, the Chambers of Commerce and their recent involvement in transportation. So I've got a PowerPoint slides in your packet here, and I'll just quickly run through those. You know, the first one just gives you an idea of some of the various topics that we're currently working on with some of the funds that we've been attracting, particularly some of the federal funds. In the area of transportation planning, in addition to the study on regional growth that I'm going to comment on, we have a large study on access to destinations, which really is trying to understand beyond congestion how travel and land use patterns are changing in the Twin Cities metropolitan area. Our researchers don't feel that congestion really gives that good a measure of how well that transportation and land use system is working. We also have a very large study funded by the American Institute of Architects on how to better design transportation facilities that are integrated into communities and what the benefits of good design of integrating those facilities are. We have a lot of activity on pricing with our Humphrey Institute on congestion value pricing. We have a very large federal grant for many years now on intelligent transportation systems, which is looking, developing technologies to manage the transportation system, to provide information to the traveler, to help on pricing mechanisms, on transit navigation, and so on. Traffic safety is another big emphasis of ours. We're part of the state's Towards Zero Deaths program, and our Humphrey Institute has a Center for Excellence in Rural Safety, where most of the fatalities are occurring in Minnesota. We also traditionally have had strong programs in infrastructure design, infrastructure engineering, with new pavement materials, new bridge construction methods. The Minroads site up near Monticello is a major national resource for research there that we've attracted federal funds for. The last two bullets are emerging areas for us. We've had strong environmental research before, particularly dealing with stormwater impacts, with air quality. The latest big topic, as you all know, is alternative fuels, and we have some great researchers working on different fuels, different approaches to fuels for vehicles. Our last one is transportation security. We've attracted some large grants from the Department of Homeland Security for monitoring behavior at transit stations, at airports, and we're trying to leverage those funds to be a major resource nationally. So those are some of the topics that we have a lot of activities going on in. I could bring back experts at any time on any of those topics if you wish to hear more about that. What I'll turn to very quickly now is to talk about a study that Professor Adams referred to earlier, a 4 or 5 year study on the relationship of transportation to regional growth. And this report that's in your packet is a summary of that. That study involved 8 research leaders. Professor Adams was one of them. They produced 16 research reports, which are all on our website. This study, this summary, about 30 pages, is a very readable synthesis of the research findings that they came up with. So I'm just briefly going to go through that. We don't have time to really go into too much depth. But we began this study to really try to understand more about the relationship of transportation and growth. And it began at a time when sprawl, smart growth were very much part of the debate. A lot of questions about what are the implications of transportation on land use, on different development patterns. And particularly what are the role of the auto versus transit versus non-motorized transportation, and how should we plan for the future? And the situation at that time has just grown to be more serious now, as you all know, with congestion continuing to increase, lack of investment in the transportation system or a low investment in the transportation system that doesn't keep up with the growth that we're having, that our commutes are longer, travel delays are projected to increase tremendously, and some funding issues, as you know. So the next four slides on what did we learn are a number of bullets of facts that this study came up with, that have implications for planning for the future. And again, I don't have time to go into depth here, but we looked at the metropolitan area. It's much bigger than the seven-county area. If you look at travel patterns, it's really, depending on the criteria you use, it's between 19 and 24 counties. The kind of development that we have had is that is rapid development out on the edges. There are incentives for that kind of development. They may not be intentional, but there are policies that encourage that kind of development. The congestion comes along with that development. We our researchers term congestion as not necessarily a problem. It's more of a symptom, but it's a very serious problem, so we need to understand it and manage it. But the problem is more of a lack of connection between land use planning, land use policies, and transportation investments. And the kind of development that we have had occur out on the edges, it traditionally has been more car-centered than involving alternative modes. We looked at environmental impacts of the kind of development that we have occurring in the transportation system. There are significant ones, but particularly some that are not that visible that are growing in importance, and that's relationship to our water system, our aquifers and underground water. As John Adams mentioned earlier, we looked at other regional centers around the state. We found very much similar patterns as the Twin Cities, particularly in those centers that are growing. That a Brainerd is a center point for communities around there, development's occurring, traffic congestion's occurring, some of those same dynamics that we find in the Twin Cities is occurring in those growing centers in Minnesota. We looked at different alternatives of addressing the transportation challenges and did not find a silver bullet. Transit doesn't necessarily cure congestion, but there certainly are some opportunities for more transit investments when you start connecting them to land use approaches, particularly approaches that cluster destinations, activity-rich destinations, and I'll come back to that. We looked at why people travel, that there's a concept of travel budget that really is consistent across the country, no matter what metropolitan area, types of modes, and so on, that people generally travel for a total of average of 70 to 75 minutes a day, an average of 20 to 25 minutes for commute time. There's a lot of anecdotes about long commutes. There certainly are longer commutes these days. But these averages have stayed consistent for several decades, which tells us that there are some reactions going on with land use as well as people's choice of travel. We looked at the cost of transportation, $27 billion for our region, divided into internal costs, which are the costs that we each pay as users, government costs, and external costs, which are costs such as pollution and congestion that aren't borne by anyone. And the largest percentage of those costs are the private costs that each of us pay, and it's primarily for our autos. And that tells us how much autos are a valued form of transportation. We're willing to pay a lot for it. However, those other the costs, the government costs and external costs, are rapidly increasing. The government costs, given the current revenue and funding mechanisms that we have in place, we will not collect enough revenue if we look out over 25 years, to pay for those government costs and needs that are out there. We particularly, again, looked at transit not only as a way to connect to better land use strategies, but it also has benefit because it helps reduce those external costs that autos incur on pollution and congestion. So those are a number of findings that these four slides just touch on. Our researchers came up with a direction. There could be several different policy directions given these findings. We came up with two directions, full cost pricing and more market choices. The last couple of slides in the handout. You've heard a little bit about this already with the discussion about impact fees. But we feel that their decisions are made if users know what they're paying for and what they pay is related to their use. So when you apply this to transportation, there are several sort of hidden costs to transportation revenues. In fact, 70% of the road-related revenues in the Twin Cities are not related to how much users travel. a gas tax, for example, is related to how much a user travels. But those fixed revenues, that sidebar on the right hand of that slide, state aid to local governments, local property taxes, motor vehicle registration taxes, are not related to use. And our, particularly our economists feel that if people are more aware of what they're paying for transportation, better decisions will be made. We also, you've covered already the types of development that are occurring that buyers, commercial developers should pay the full cost of infrastructure development over time. Impact fees is one strategy of a way to do that. We're just saying that ought to happen and that both those strategies would let the market work, leading to better decision, more efficient use of resources. So that's full cost pricing. The other strategic direction that our researchers are suggesting that we go in the future is more market choices on both land use and transportation strategy, that we gear our policies to accommodate trends that are already evident, you know, that are providing some positive directions. And one trend that's evident even in the suburban areas in development is a desire for more downtown-like environments. And that's very positive from a transportation point of view, because when you cluster different destination types together, as you have in downtown Minneapolis, you're not dependent solely on the auto to get from one to the other. You know, 40% of the bus trips to Minneapolis and the commute are 40% of the work trips are by bus to Minneapolis. And that's because once people are there, they can access a number of different destinations. So more policies that encourage that kind of development give some choices in transportation. We feel that, you know, we still need improved roads and expanded bus service and carefully designed commuter and rail lines could all be transportation strategies that help accommodate that development. So I'll quickly close here. That's one study that we have that has some implications for planning. As I said, we have several others that I'd be glad to talk more about or bring some experts here. And with that, I'll be glad to take questions.
Thank you. Members, questions? Representative Shumper.
Yes, Mr. Johns, on page 6, full cost pricing, the second point there, does that imply where you have potential home buyers and commercial developers should pay the full cost of infrastructure development? Are you saying then that if the Vikings want to build a stadium in downtown Minneapolis, that they should pay all the infrastructure costs? I hope you're saying that. I'll support that.
Mr. Johns.
Madam Chair, Representative, one could make a case for that.
I thought you did.
Yes. Our researchers were talking more about the kind of development that occurs out in the exurbs, where you have very cheap land, you have attractive, low-cost housing, but if that development keeps growing, eventually you have infrastructure costs that aren't borne by those early developers, early buyers. And it's very related to the impact fees discussion. But some of those same principles, I think, would apply to our sports teams.
Other questions? If not, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Representative Hausman.
Madam Chair, I understood you to say you would be bringing a bill forward. Is that my understanding?
Yes, Representative Hausman. I will be carrying a bill to bring back the Department of Planning, and it's basically because of the comments that we have heard from the governors at our first training session. I believe all three of the governors talked about how important planning was to the future of Minnesota. So, yes, there will be a bill to do that. Hopefully you'll all support it. With that, if there's no further questions, Representative Lanning.
No, thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to do a follow-up comment to Professor Adams' presentation. I think all of us support good and planning, and we need more planning probably than less. But I think that the assertion that we don't have any development impact fees is not correct. We may not call them that, but if you look around the state, talk to local government officials, they have been very creative at extracting money from developments to cover the costs associated with that development, both on-site as well as off-site. And so I don't know to what extent Professor Adams has talked to local government officials around the state, but if anybody's seriously wanting to pursue down this road of development impact fees, let's find out from local government officials, first of all of what they've been doing creatively to do that. I can think of all kinds of things my city did to extract support for needed improvements as a result of a development project. And so I don't want this session to go by with people having the impression that cities are not collecting from developers, because they are. They may not call it a development impact fee, but there's lots of things going on.
Thank you, Representative Lanning, and that is actually one thing that I was going to ask Ms. Dyson, if she could look through the statutes and find out what local units of government are already authorized to charge, and then I will be also requesting from the League of Cities, I don't think anyone is here, what common practice currently is. But I don't have a bill to do those fees, just so you know. Representative Beard.
Madam Chair, helpful information on that line. One of the cities that I fondly represent, Shakopee, just I believe they're in maybe for council you could look into this. What we call BATSE, Builders Association of Twin Cities, launched a lawsuit against Shakopee because we had gotten so darn creative, as Representative Lanning talked about all the things we piled into building fees and plat fees and every other kind of fee we nail them with. And, oh, by the way, some of us are not fan of fees. It kind of happens to us. But anyhow, just know that there is a lawsuit, and I'm not sure if it's been settled or if there is a pending settlement in that is requiring the cities to actually justify the fees they're laying on development. Just a thought.
We will look into that as well. All right. Further, Representative Scalzi.
Yes, and thanks, Ms. Chair. And in addition to that, I mean, I came from local government, too, so I know how creative local cities can be. But I'm just wondering, what do school districts have to say about this, which would lead to my example of the one in Florida. How can they require schools to be built or money to be put into schools, which would be different than what cities are authorized to do, because cities see the development plats as they come in for approval, but school districts don't necessarily see those, and that's where I think it kind of falls apart. There's a difference.
Maybe we could ask staff to also talk with the school district staff so that they can maybe have a comprehensive look at the issue. Further questions or comments? With that, we did approve the minutes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. With that, this meeting is adjourned.